Hi, welcome to Outrageous, our bi-weekly podcast where we talk about race, media, politics, culture, and everything in between. Yet again, I am joined by my two very best friends, Trisha in LA.
Hello.
And Jason in DC.
What's up?
You know, I whenever I do the introduction, I don't know if you go back and listen, in the transition between announcing the name and your names, I like forget your names. Is that weird?
Who you
I'm
are?
Always like, I'm joined by my two very best friends, Trisha in LA.
I never
introduced myself. I'm Chris and I'm in New York. I never introduced myself. It's as if I just expect everyone to know who I am.
Well, they do. Don't worry. Everyone
knows.
Well, I think the trick for an announcer is to introduce yourself first.
Yeah. So I'd be like, so starting next time I'll be like, I'm Chris from New York.
Yep.
And I'm joined by
yep.
Yeah. Well, this was a great like production meeting that we had live.
I think you need a teleprompter.
This has been
Chris.
Thrilling.
You need a teleprompter.
I do need a teleprompter. I need one of those Obama teleprompters. Remember when everyone was giving Obama shit for using a teleprompter? And I was like,
Isn't that TV?
Didn't people of old like have like notes in front of them where people are expected to memorize entire 20-minute speeches?
Well, the whole idea that I don't understand why the critique evolved. Teleprompters are essential for TV, period. Everyone uses them.
Well, no, it's just, what can we criticize Obama for?
Oh, it was weird.
Championing the healthcare program we've all been championing for 3 decades, we will now criticize him for it and call it socialism.
So odd. That was
weird. So weird. It's like, he uses a teleprompter. He should memorize all those speeches. And it's like, first of all, you don't like him because he talks. Now you don't like him. You don't like him because he says anything. Now you don't like him because he speaks coherently. Like, what do you want him to do? Just like, ugh. But I guess that's what their candidates do. So,
I mean,
You know, Trump doesn't have a teleprompter.
No, there was a story. He used one for the first time.
But he does
He's just been riffing.
I think I heard that he did recently, but everyone was like, it was still the same shit. He just, like, put the same shit on a teleprompter. It's like, well, that was different. Like, why bother?
Poor America. All of us. So, before we get started, is there anything new that anybody wants to announce that's going on in their world?
What's new in my world? No, nothing. Sorry.
Wow.
I thought I had something.
Okay, then I'll cut this part out because that is terrible to hear. This is terrible to hear.
What, you don't have anything new either, huh?
I could come up with something. Let me think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I decided recently that I'm recommitting myself to seeing a lot of Broadway shows. That's something. When Trisha lived in New York, we spent a lot of time doing that. And there was that one particular year, I don't remember when it was, but we saw every single thing on Broadway. Remember, Trish?
Yep. It was great.
Wow, that's incredible.
But there wasn't anything great on Broadway. That's why I think you opted out. For a while, it was like repetition.
For a while, there was a lot of jukebox musicals. That was very big in the past 10 years. And then there was a lot of just bullshit that I didn't want to see. But, you know, there's a lot of things I want to see now, like Color Purple and Shuffle Along. And there's a bunch of people of color on stage, so I wanted to check that out.
It's always good to check out people of color while we still live and breathe and exist.
I know, honey. Well, once November rolls around, Trump will see to all of them.
We'll be rolling out of town.
I like how we joke about that until like it happens, and we'll be like, we can't believe it's happening. You know, everyone's goose-stepped.
I will say that I always thought he had a good shot at the nomination, and people who thought that wasn't a chance, like I disagree with them. I did not think he had any shot at the presidency until, like, this past week. And now I'm actually – it looks to me like he has a real shot at it, and that's really concerning to me.
Well, what are you going to do? I mean, Jason, you have kids. You're trapped in this country. Me and Trisha can just be up and out.
No. I don't know what I'm going to do. I really don't.
Teach your kids. Start teaching your kids Dutch and then move to Amsterdam.
They all speak English there.
All right, well, let's jump into our topics this week. We have a lot of exciting stuff to talk about. So why doesn't eeny, meeny, miny, Jason?
So I'm going to continue along the line that I did in our last episode. I'm going to bring up education again. And
which I want to point out that last, last episode, Jason was like, I don't like to talk about it because I do it all day. And now that's all you can talk about.
No, yeah, and that, now that the seal is broken, I'm like, I'm doing education every week.
Now you're pissed. You're mad as hell. Yeah,
exactly. And so it is related to the particular topic. So, you know, last time I brought up the issue of should we have a national education system. And we talked about how there's been a backlash to even like the tiniest hint of something that we do collectively in education. Well, what the biggest manifestation of that right now is what is called the opt-out movement. And so what we have is every state by federal law administers standardized tests. It used to be that all of us, every state administered its own standardized test. You now have a couple of consortiums where there's a certain group of states, Maryland is one of them, that administer what's called the PARC assessment, and another group of states that do the Smarter Balanced assessment, and then a bunch of states that are like, we're not doing that, we're doing our own thing. But in any case, in several states, most notably the great state of New York, where Chris is currently seated, there is a movement, and the movement in almost every case is of middle-class white parents who opt out of sending their kids to school on the day the test is administered. Usually the reason given is, I don't want my kids stressed out, standardized tests, you know, stress my kid out. That's like the biggest one. Sometimes it's like, well, I think these standardized tests are forcing teachers to teach to the test, and that narrows instruction, and my kids aren't getting, you know, what they need. Another thing is like there aren't stakes to the test. Like, I'm going to send my kid when it's the SAT because that will determine where they go to college or whether they go to college. But this PARC test is just to, you know, measure their school effectiveness, and if my kid doesn't benefit directly from it, you know, I'm not sending them. So that's been kind of the movement. I think there are a lot of potential problems with this, but the one I want to ask you two about is, what you're supposed to get from the test is you're supposed to get data or information about your child's progress, how well did they do from one test to another in terms of making progress at achieving standards. You're supposed to get information about whether they have achieved standards, so proficiency rates, are they proficient in this area? And finally, you're supposed to get data on how are they doing compared to other kids across the state, or if other states are taking the same test across the country, you know, other kids in the same grade level. Are they at the 10th percentile, 50th percentile, 90th percentile? The question I want to raise is, parents who are saying, I'm not going to send my kid because they might get stressed out or whatever, are they actually, is it irresponsible to not have that kind of data so you don't know what kind of progress is your child making? I mean, you get your kid's report card, but that's not standardized to anything. You know, that there's no standard. It's totally subjective based on one teacher's view. And so is it irresponsible to not take advantage of this opportunity to get information about how your child's doing compared to their peers, compared to how they were doing a year ago, and based on the standards that, you know, the state government has determined they need to learn to be successful?
Is it irresponsible to not take advantage of the opportunity to blah, blah, blah? So you acknowledge, right, it's a way for people to receive additional information. And so is it irresponsible to not receive additional information? I understand why you're frustrated as an educator, but listening to as you laid out, I can kind of see the other side. Now, full disclosure, I tend not to get up in parenting choices that upper middle class white people are doing, because as far as I'm concerned, it's all stupid shit anyway. Like, oh, my kids will be gluten free even though they don't have a gluten allergy. Knock yourself out. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what to say. I think that's dumb, but okay. The only time I really get upset about these sorts of things and when, like, the vaccination issue, because that affects other people, right? So if they decide that they want to send their kids to school and then they don't, I guess they don't. What are you saying? That these tests measure school effectiveness. So I guess the parents are like, they don't care if the school's effective. Like, that just seems like a silly decision to make, alongside all the silly decisions that parents make all the time. I would have to hear more about how it impacts the entire system in a global way, and then maybe I can get up in arms about it. Trish?
Well, that was my initial instinct, actually. My initial instinct is that this feels to me like the typical trend towards full individual value system. Like, I don't care how this relates to the global universe of education for other kids, but this is just about me and my damn kid. And I don't care if this information is going to feed into something larger. I just want to make sure that my kid is not going to be inconvenienced in any way, shape, or form, which then begs the question, like, why do you even participate in public education anyway? Like, you kind of have to buy in, and it sounds to me like these parents don't buy in to it. And so in some ways, I want to know the exact same thing. Like, does this have repercussions for non-self-indulgent middle-class kids later? Like, will it impact poor kids? Will it have some sort of detrimental impact on other kids whose parents don't have the luxury of making these kinds of choices? That's what I want to know, Jason.
Yeah, okay. No, this is good. I appreciate your responses. So there are three things why I think there are three potential impacts of this that I think are problematic. One is where you were kind of going, Tricia. If we don't have a significant enough, you know, sample size, or now it's not at this point yet, but if the opt-out movement gains enough ground that there's a substantial, and there actually are individual districts in the state of New York where this has been the case, if more than, let's say, like 20% of the kids in a district don't take it, then the validity of the results comes into question, especially if, let's say, all of the low-income kids and all the kids of color are taking it, but now you're not comparing them against enough other kids, so you're getting skewed data, right? You're comparing kids of the same demographic with each other. So that's one problem, is like you don't get good data for kids who are taking it. Second problem is that the national teachers unions are really, they tend to be against standardized testing because it can be used to evaluate teachers and potentially terminate or pay teachers less. And in New York, again, to bring it back to New York for a second, that New York has a state teacher evaluation system that does tie student performance on test scores, or has tied student performance on test scores strongly to teacher evaluations. Now, that's another issue which I have a different opinion on, and we can talk about it if you want. But so the teachers unions don't like it, and so the teachers unions have been funding this parent opt-out movement for a totally different reason. Like, parents don't tend to have much of an opinion about whether test scores should be used to evaluate teachers, but they may be like, I don't want my kids stressed out. But then there's this funding that's brought to bear because the teachers union interest is to get rid of the test. So all of that to say, there becomes a political pressure.
Teachers unions are terrible. There, I said it.
Well, so you have like Governor Cuomo in New York, who I think has been great on education for the most part. This opt-out movement has pushed him to remove his endorsement of certain things like this testing. And that's dangerous because it could get to a point where there's no testing like this, and then there's no data for anyone. And then the last negative impact, I think, which was kind of the root of my question, like the first two things I can argue with my education hat on and be like, this is problematic for our ability to provide a high quality education to all of our kids. But the last one gets to a cultural, well, here's my question. Is this a cultural problem? I mean, I do worry that the whole, like, my kid's going to get stressed out, and like that to me seems indicative of the same trends in our culture of, like, you know, my kid needs to get a trophy because my kid participated, and we don't want our kids to ever feel bad about anything. Like, how do we remove the possibility that any kid feels picked on, or, you know, like, I just worry that that's where our culture is going, and that's ultimately bad for our kids. The last thing I'll say, and then I'll punt it back to you too. There are surveys that show that while our kids in the United States collectively are way behind kids in many other countries, our kids are number one in confidence. Like, our kids are number one consistently in believing they are good at math, whereas they're actually not good at math.
I have thoughts about data. Standardized testing has always been sort of problematic because we have been wondering what it has been testing. We've been wondering whether what it tests is actually an indication of propensity for success in the world, propensity for success in colleges, things like that. And what's been really intriguing to me about this sort of small discussion that we've even started now is that we've never been able to get any traction about resisting standardized testing when it was lobbied by parents of kids of color and poor people who've been sort of challenging the very question about standardized tests. But yet, again, here we are with a group of parents who have the money and the wherewithal, I guess, now to actually shift this discussion simply because they don't want their kids inconvenienced. Whereas before, we couldn't even shift this discussion when we were figuring out if the test had any real merit.
Right, or if it was culturally biased.
And if it was culturally biased. You know what I mean? So on one hand, I sort of applaud the idea of us even bringing the larger question of the test into this space, right? Maybe this test doesn't measure anything that's of value, and we can say, skedaddle with this test, right? Because we've been having this ongoing dialogue around standardized testing for so long. And then there's another part of me that's freaking angry that now that I have to think about now that one person or a couple parents are thinking about their kids' feelings, this is the space where standardized testing might actually be rejected. Which is then to say I've now arrived at this place after these two incidences where now I'm just like, okay, maybe I won't even care about the reasons why, but if we get to reject standardized testing as a means of evaluating kids, I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, because people have been asking if we could use other measures for a long time, right?
I don't know where I fall down on this.
Right?
I want to jump in and lambast these parents, because again, it feels like Park Slope, Brooklyn, like indulgent parenting.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm just sort of like, just stop your nonsense. But on the other hand, I do think that our ideas and our attention to standardized tests might be a little flawed. So it's hard for me to like jump on those parents, because that would mean I'd have to in some way raise the flag of standardized testing, and I don't know if I want to do that. You know, I don't know if that's where I really want to be. I do feel that if you enroll your kid in public school, that I can't defend the statements I'm going to make. What I was going to say is, I feel like
you're
if you enroll your kid
into
in public
a system,
school,
right?
You have to, yes, and you have to submit to the process. Like, we provide your child with a free education, and you provide us with a little bit of data about how we're doing and how we can make this better, not for other kids, but also for your future kids who might come through this school.
Right.
But then to mandate that feels awkward as well, because those tests are used on an individual basis to determine children's placement in school later, to determine their educational futures. I understand why parents might not want that to go down.
Except, isn't that weird, though? I mean, it's like saying I want to opt out of breathing. I mean,
it's kind of like, I want to go to the doctor, but not find out how I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because at this juncture...
Hold on a sec, Trisha. Hold that thought. That's like going to the doctor, James, do a survey afterwards and says, how am I doing? And the parent goes, man, I don't give a shit. I got what I needed, and leaves. That's what that's like.
No, but that's not useful.
But the test is going to give you data about how you're doing. It's like going to the doctor and getting a flu shot. So I got my flu shot, so I'm vaccinated. Yeah, I know you listened to my heartbeat and you did an EKG. I don't want to see the data. I got my flu shot. I'm not going to get the flu. Like, I don't know. I mean, maybe we should not spend too much time on the analogy. But
we should abandon this metaphor. Trish, I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead, Trish.
We jumped all over your points with that shitting.
And now you must retreat.
I know.
No, I actually think, you know, it's weird, right? There's a part of me that really appreciates people pushing back on systems, right? There, obviously, I love when we question the value of a system.
Yes, we're iconoclasts.
Yeah, we appreciate that. However, they're not questioning the value of the system because, in some sense, they want to participate in moving and shaping the system in a way that's going to be helpful in the long run. They're basically just questioning the system on a very, very specific and particular instance, which is not about the system. It's just about their own child. And to me, that is where I'm not entirely comfortable, because on some level, we are all, not on some, on an important level, we're all in this together. So we all have to sometimes participate in things so that the knowledge that we acquire can be shared and help a sort of general cause. And I feel like what Jason's saying is that that's the part of this that I'm attacking. I'm attacking the failure to participate subtext that's really happening here, which is like, as long as my kid's okay, I don't really care about anybody else's kids. How can you participate in public systems then if that attitude undergirds what you're doing?
I And I feel like I don't want to subvert your topic, Jason, but also I feel like there's other aspects of this that I want to attack. I want to push back on the idea that, you know, upper middle class parents are constantly moving into expert spaces.
Yep.
Because they feel like they're experts on their children, that they're experts on everything having to do with their children, which is not does not follow. Mm-hmm. So they think that they're virologists. They think that they are educators. You know, they think they are mental health professionals. Right. And these things are not true. And it's damaging,
that's right.
I would say, to their kids and their entire family, but you can't tell them that. And that's what I want to push back on, this encroachment of parents into expert spaces.
And can I say, this reminds me of an article I read several months ago, I think. It was about a charter school in a particular neighborhood in Brooklyn, I think. And the charter school was fairly well attended by kids of color, and it was actually a really good school. However, the neighborhood was being gentrified, and a lot of sort of upper middle class parents moved in and decided that they wanted a totally different school because they presumed that the school that was filled with people of color was just not good for their kids. Mm-hmm. And they proceeded to...
Oh, I heard about this story.
Right? And they just proceeded to...
I'm just kidding. This is every story in every neighborhood in New York. Oh,
but they proceeded to have this whole experience around education that was just about them. So much so that they ended up in some ways gutting some of the resources from a perfectly...
Of course.
Well-meaning and actually highly functioning school in their neighborhood. But they had presumed that because the school was filled with kids of color, it was necessarily bad.
Right.
So I think I don't like the entree into
Welcome
these
to
spaces.
Every part of downtown Brooklyn, by the way.
Right. Well, and by the way, housing is the same way. Oh, black people moving in. We're moving out. Property values go down.
Well, I just...
Trisha, you know what's funny? Your old neighborhood in Brooklyn, I passed by your old apartment.
Yeah.
First, what you're describing is that entire section of Brooklyn right now. Everyone moved in and they were like, oh, they took one look at the schools.
Yeah.
And
just the outside.
They took one look at the schools, they pulled all their. They sent them all to private schools. In the past couple of years, they started sending their kids back to the schools. Like envoys, like to the schools, and now here come the parents after them talking about, like, oh, we need to change everything about it. And the schools in that neighborhood are not poor.
And they were good schools.
And by poor, I mean in quality. They're, yeah.
Well, that's the interesting thing, right? Because what happened was this article was actually a white parent who had chosen to let their kid go into the neighborhood school and was exposing the other parents, their biases, and asking them to sort of reflect on that. And so for me, I just, that's why I'm resisting this trend that you're talking about, Jason, is because it's built around personal bias. If it was built around something else, if it was a real attacking of the systemic culture around standardized testing, I'd be okay with that, because that tells me that they're thinking about the group. But this is just about...
They're not thinking about the room.
No, they're just thinking about themselves. And I resist anything that is always about the self, because I know that we live together. And so we have to live together or die together. But apparently these people think that their kids are going to be the ones that are on the raft boats while the rest of the world is sinking.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate this conversation. Your thoughts are really helpful. The two things I want to say are, one, so in terms of these parents and their kids, I think that they're just wrong about their kids are going to be fine. And I think the data supports that, because if Harvard completely didn't look at race, it would be completely Asian and Asian American. It would basically be Chinese and Chinese Americans, like the whole student population.
Don't tell anybody that.
No, but that's the thing. And that's true of so the thing is, like, their kids are not fine. They're wrong. And they don't want to see the data that tells them otherwise. But if you look at international testing data, it is absolutely true. The second thing, now to get back to the group, is, so standardized testing, if you look at the history of it, there's been cultural bias. How do we use the test? There's like a ton to critique. But the problem with not, so I am all for like overhaul, and we need better tests, and we need to use them in a more effective way, in a less biased way, all of that. But my concern about the absence of comparative data in terms of how kids are doing compared to other kids is that there's every reason to believe that if we don't have data that shows how kids are doing compared to other kids, kids of color will be the ones who get fucked.
How just, so?
Well, because our whole history has been, investing disproportionately in the education of white children, and particularly upper-income white children. And so right now, so if we look at, like, let's put standardized tests to the side for a second, and let's look at, like, public education, what is it producing for kids? Well, I mean, the best thing to look at, right, would be income level, wealth level, college completion levels. Well, if we look at all those things, there's no question kids of color are getting fucked. Like, our public education system is not providing them with upward mobility. Now, I don't mean to say that as a way of just to demonize the public education system, because that's happening in the context of so many other things that are against kids of color. But if we see public education as what is supposed to be the mechanism for upward mobility, which throughout, you know, at least the 20th century, that was the case for lots of white kids from working class families, that was something that worked for a long while. But that has not worked for kids of color. So then you say, okay, well, clearly, if we're going to provide a public education that is going to prepare kids of color to get middle class incomes to rise in terms of their socioeconomic class, it's not happening now, so we need to do something different. Okay, so let's say we do something different. We're going to teach reading and math and science and social studies in a totally different way. Well, how are we going to get data about whether that's actually making a difference? Are we going to wait 14 years, right? Like, so kid enters pre-K, and we're going to try this whole new thing. We're going to do it for 14 years, and then in 14 years, we'll see if your kid gets a better income. Well, of course, that's unacceptable, because chances are, you know, that won't happen. So we need data along the way to see how they're progressing. And the only way to do that is through standardized assessment. I'm not saying we shouldn't do other kinds of assessment. I'm not saying we should be teaching to standardized assessments. I don't think that. But we need some comparative data to say, here are the standards we know a child needs to achieve to succeed in our economy. You know, here's how we can look at how's your child doing towards achieving those things, and how are they doing compared to their peers with whom they will be competing to get into institutions of higher education and with whom they'll be competing to get jobs.
The only solution is just to compare kids of color with each other and internationally and say, screw the middle class kids.
That's actually a fascinating idea I've never thought of. There's an assessment called the PISA. That's like the gold standard right now, an international assessment to compare kids in different countries. Maybe we should just, good. All right, Trisha came with a solution. That's what I'm talking about. All right, fuck the middle class.
I mean, it's a global economy now. So just compare kids of color to an international kid.
All right, that was the most satisfying conversation we've had, as far as I'm concerned. that was awesome. I'm ready. All right, next topic. Problem solved, baby. That's what I'm talking about.
Let's move on to Trisha's topic. What are you talking about?
I was reading some tweets about a fairly well-known activist that I follow on Twitter. And this activist gets attacked all the time about whether he is being paid for the things that he tweets, or if he is being paid to communicate at conventions and different kinds of spaces where I think his point of view is very important. He's sort of he's known within Black Lives Matter movement, and so his point of view is sort of always being explored, and he's always sort of invited as a guest to talk about, you know, America's political system, democracy, education, all manner of things from a sort of Black Lives Matter perspective. And one of the major areas where he's constantly attacked is around money and the presumption that if he is ever paid, that he has somehow been dirtied by the process. And it just got me thinking about activists and how people expect activists to sort of thrive and continue to do good work while being poor. And I just wonder if this is just...
Interesting question.
Right? I mean,
this is, by the way, this is what you're describing is a very big part of my life. I have strong opinions about this, but go ahead.
Okay, good. So, I mean, I don't know. So maybe I'll stop there and let you all give me your initial impressions about what I'm saying so that maybe we can sort of parcel this out a little bit. Because I'm trying to figure out why we have this bias. And why I think on some level that bias is really destructive for activism just in general and for us even to progress.
you may be familiar with, there's an organization called Industrialized Areas Foundation, which is what Saul Alinsky founded. It was it started out as a Chicago housing-based or housing-focused community organizing effort. It's what Obama was trained in, and there's a strong chapter in Baltimore that I've had the honor of being involved with here and there. They define a movement as organized money and organized people, or money and people organized around a message that resonates. I have my very strong feeling about this is, to effect social change, which is what activists try to do, and I'd like to think I try to do in my day job, it takes money, like, period. Putting aside for a second whether you get paid or not, like, it takes money. I mean, we know this. Our political system, our country, there are moneyed interests on all sides of every issue, and on many issues, much bigger moneyed interests on one side than another. Power in our society, arguably all societies, but certainly ours, the currency of power is money. If you're going to make social change, there's going to be money involved. Now, how that money gets spent could be highly debated, how much of it goes into people's salaries versus marketing versus independent expenditures in a political campaign. You need money to make change. To get to the question of like whether an activist should get paid, I think my answer to your question, Trisha, which is where I think you were kind of leading, is like we need to pay activists because if your day job, if you're doing something totally different in your day job, the extent to which you have the time and the opportunity to push what needs to be pushed is going to be extremely limited, right? I mean, even Rosa Parks, her day job was working for the NAACP, right? So, what I strive to do is raise enough money to pay myself to do the work I do, which is advocating for better education policy, to be able to do that full time. I have a hell of a hard time doing it full time. If I was like working in a restaurant during the day and then just trying to do it at night, I wouldn't get shit done. So then the last thing I would say is, I get critiqued a lot about where my money comes from. I do raise money from people with whom I disagree on a lot of issues. But, I can say for myself, I am very careful that when I take money from someone, if there are any strings attached, those strings are ones I agree with in terms of the policy I'm working on. And if there are strings attached that pull me in a direction I think is wrong, I don't take the money. Now, you can always debate whether an activist is exercising integrity in taking the money, but at the end of the day, if an activist is pushing for change that I think is truly needed, that there's data to support is truly needed, I don't care where they get the money from. I'm fine with them getting paid to do that. I think that's better. I think this conversation of, oh, you're getting paid or, oh, you're taking money from X, I feel very strongly if you're pushing for the right things, you need to get paid to do that. You need to be raising money to do that, and that should be applauded. That's how change gets made.
I think that when we have social activists out there championing for societal change, cultural change, part of the backlash against that is – And it's juvenile, but part of the backlash against that is like, well, if you're so against this, you must be against everything in society. And I think what that comes to is money and capitalism, right? So the idea that, oh, if you somehow want money to live while you're championing for Black Lives Matter, you're a terrible, terrible person, right? And that doesn't even make sense, but somehow that makes sense for people who counter social movements. Obviously, I feel that, yes, if you are in a social movement and you are really championing for change, you have to live, right? And in our society, you need money to live. And so you should get money somehow. And someone's going to have to pay you. It's great if the movement you're working on can somehow siphon money to you. But it becomes complicated in that, like, yeah, Jason, you make sure that the money that you're taking doesn't run counter to the causes that you're championing. But I wonder... I'm sorry, guys. My thoughts are all over the place. I just feel like, one, it's a bit of like, are people rejecting like the ruthlessness and sort of like cold calculation of like, I'll take money from anywhere to move my movement forward? Because in some way that speaks to your character. And if your movement has anything to do with justice or integrity, like, are you not sort of slapping that in the face, like slapping, but see also Hillary Clinton in Wall Street.
Well,
Hillary Clinton, yeah. And by the way, I'm making this comparison only to highlight what I'm saying, which I'm having a lot of trouble getting across, not so much to identify Hillary Clinton as a social justice warrior. just like with Hillary Clinton, this whole flap about Wall Street and release what you said to them, et cetera, she went to go speak to Wall Street. She needed money. She said what they wanted to hear to get the money to run for president to make the change that she thinks will be important for the country. But now we want to blast her because it's sort of like, well, if you didn't really believe the things you were saying, are you not in some way like really cold and calculating? And what does that say for you as an instrumental piece in moving some sort of movement forward? Like, are you not in some way two-faced, and how can we trust you now?
Well, can I say real quick, so I understand why you bring up that analogy, but the thing is, we know what Wall Street's interests are, and we know what they will expect Hillary Clinton to do because they've invested in her. And we know the power she will have to do those things. That's very different. I mean, there's some overlap. The other thing I want to say is, the thing about where you get money from, and like I have this debate a lot with people. To me, the way change gets made in this society always is when there's an intersection of interest. And that intersection may come, you know, there may be an intersection of interest among parties that disagree on a whole lot of other things. Now, if I go to an organization that, let's say, like, I disagree with them, a foundation, like let's say a wealthy family, because I mean honestly this is how things work in my world. There's a wealthy family. They may be pro-life and they may be pro-gun rights or whatever, but they are also, we agree on education policy, and they want to give me $1 million to work on education policy that we agree is best for our country. I have no problem taking their money, because my argument to the, like, oh, but they have these other views, I'm not going to market them. Now, that's a fine line, but, like, I'm careful. I'm not going to market them in a way that helps their other views. And if I don't take their money to work on this thing in education, they have the money, right? Like, they have it. So would we prefer that they put more money into their pro-life movement? Would we prefer that they put more money into their pro-gun rights movement? Or would they prefer that they invest it in something that's actually going to help kids?
But if they give you the money, is there not an understanding that you are not going to work against them?
Well, no, not for that cost.
No,
not for that cost.
Not even for others. Like, no, I mean, what you're saying, Chris, is the right question. And, I mean, this is where there's a certain amount of trust that then comes into play. Like, people would critique me and say, like, oh, well, then you're on board for blah, 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 blah. I mean, you know, then it does get to personal integrity. And so questions can be raised, but like as long as I stay on the record as like I'm not touching those other issues, and I may even speak out against their position on other issues. Like I mean, it's a fine line. I get that. But like that's why we need to invest in activism.
All right. Well, Tricia, you say what you're gonna. I have questions, but Tricia.
Okay. All right. Let me pull you all back a little bit, because I think one of the things that I think we need to be clear about is how do you enact change, right? Because this is part of the challenge, right? Because people want to believe that you, in order to move a system towards justice, either you have to buy into the idea that the system has to be completely dismantled, in which case you can't take any benefits from that system, i.e. money.
That's what I was getting at earlier, yes.
Or you have to subscribe to this model that the system is actually complex and interdependent, and that you can be working to move the system in one direction and still pull resources from that system, because we can't exist outside of the system and meaningfully impact it, really. Because that's really where the tension lies, right? Where will you get your money? Where will that money come from if you need right. to use money to make things happen? If you need to use money to fly to a city to meet somebody, if you need to use money to, I mean, there you need money for basic things. We don't have free housing. We don't have free healthcare. We don't have things that let you live. So in some ways, I always go back to that model of save yourself first before you save another. What I like to...
You'd be great on a plane.
Right, but you know, but that's what they say, right?
So
that's why I ask about... I think maybe one piece to help this puzzle is transparency.
So, okay, well, say more about that before we can respond. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, in the sense of what... In Jason's explanation, right? Jason is saying, well, I have taken money from this resource because we agree in this area. I don't agree with all the other three or four or five things that this family represents, but there's this place where we meet. And so we can agree on this and work towards this end. Tomorrow, I'm going to be meeting with another group of people, and we might be working against their initiative on pro-life.
But that's not...
But we have to be willing to do that. It can't... I just don't understand how we can't have a sort of complex notion of who we are as people and how systems work.
Listen, I 100% sign on to what you're saying. But optics, especially when it comes to fundraising and movements, are extremely important. Optics are the thing, you know?
Without action? I mean, because that's the thing. That's what happens. People believe optics.
Look at Congress. This is Congress. Hell no caucus. Like, we will not work with them on anything because of this one thing, and nothing gets done. And Congress has always worked by people who totally disagree on some things. They find an intersection of interest, and they get it done. And, like, we can't get anything done now because everyone's in their friggin' corner because – yeah, anyway, sorry.
Well,
it's shortcut thinking in my mind.
And I get it, and I totally agree with you, but I don't know what we do about that. Like, I mean, you're going to be the Obama about this, try to introduce the American public that sometimes these things are complex. We saw that work, so they got rejected out of hand. We don't want to deal with that. You know what? Obama came to office, and he was like, I'm going to offer complex solutions to complex problems.
You're right.
And the American public said, you know what? We want Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump.
That's right.
So,
but you know, Obama reminded
baby, no complexity.
How do we move forward with the idea that complexity is a thing, people? Get into bed with it.
Well, you know why? Because we are complex animals. Because
I don't disagree, but my question is, Trisha, how do we introduce that? How do we begin?
We can reintroduce it because, you know what? Start first and foremost with yourself. It is why every religious system says, take the spoke out of your eye first. Begin with yourself. You are sitting around telling yourself that you hate gay people and you have gay desires. Deal with that first.
Serious.
You know what I mean?
Oh,
like, you know what I mean? Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, confront yourself. If you started with yourself and people started with themselves on a very honest level, they would look inside of themselves and see how complicated and how up and down they are. One day they're feeling this way, but yet they're acting that way. You know, you can begin there. And once you start there, you can then look out into the world and say, does the world function similarly? Oh, yeah, it does kind of, right? This looks like... I mean, it's just like, for me, it's a rejection of your own complexity. That is the problem. And because
you were describing a well-educated, self-motivated person who is interested in these sorts of things. Because you know what? The human beings were so afraid of their own complexity, they discovered religion to make things super simple. So, like, it's sin or it's not sin, right?
It's
God's favor, it's not God's favor. So asking people to look inside their own faults, you know, is going to make them extremely anxious, which is why people start praying and bullshit like that.
Yeah. Or you know what? I totally agree with that.
I just want to put that out there. Religious listeners, we don't want to alienate all of you at once.
You know what? I'll alienate anyone. These are my opinions, and they are outrageous, okay? Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, this is bullshit.
But you know what?
The world is complex, Trisha, and we are super complex. And the fact that we have things like religion proves that human beings cannot deal with their own complexity.
Okay, but that's what you can start with. What I'm saying is admit that there is always a desire in you to simplify. Admit that desire. Because if you can admit that desire, then you don't have to admit to your complexity. You could just admit that there's a desire in me to make this either or, when oftentimes it's not. Because that's what it is. I mean, like, I honest to goodness, that is the thing and the trend that I am completely sick of, and it even comes right back around to Jason's topic. It's like, if it's not about my kids, I don't care. Well, guess what? You're in a world with other people's kids. It's not that simple. So it's just, I do really feel like there's just like a simplification trend that I cannot abide by.
All right.
On this idea So if I return to the activists, what I want people to understand is that An activist can care very passionately about an issue and still get up every day and participate in elements of the very system that they're trying to change. Because we can't do it. We can't live outside of it. We're not doing it. And if you do, then you become the Unabomber. I mean, it's really hard. You know, it really is. And so it's a real kind of push-pull. And as long as that person attempts to remain transparent and says what they're doing, I think we have to begin to give people the benefit of the doubt. We cannot let cynicism allow us to undercut activists, because I think that's really what I'm concerned about, is that if you hold activists to these really hard and fast standards, you've essentially hamstrung them so they can't make change happen.
Which I'm sure is part of the plan.
That's part of it. That's part of the plan, because I also feel like somebody said it's exactly the example you give. What? You don't believe in breathing air? Well, then let me take away your air.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
It's like, you want to reject everything about society? Well, give me those clothes off your back.
Exactly.
It's like, why do I have to be naked to advocate for change in education or women's rights? Like, why do I have to reject every aspect of what's going on here? Like, I start off by saying, like, that is the juvenile reaction, but that is people's reaction. Again, because it's the simplicity of it. People want to introduce simplicity to it. Like, oh, you want to reject how we're living? That means you're rejecting everything about how we live. And those two things do not necessarily connect.
And they don't have to. And you can pull apart little pieces of it. Like, you reject educational inequality, but yet you're up here dancing to a Beyonce video. Oh, what? You know what I mean? Like, what we can say is that I have a little bit of the villain in me, or I have a little bit of the, you know, the Marxist and the capitalist in me. But, you know,
I'm
it's just like, yeah.
I would just say that, like, you know, I want to, no, because I feel, strike that. I think that we spend too much time worrying that our social justice warriors are not perfect people.
Yeah.
And in some way that has to detract from all the work that they're doing. So no, you can be out there marching for Black Lives Matter. You can be out there trying to repeal drug laws. You could be out there doing all that stuff, and you can get lit on the club on Saturday night. Those two things, they don't run counter, right? Because you're a human being. And I think the idea that we want people who want change to be perfect is just part of the establishment's plot to make sure that we don't have any social change. So
I think so too.
I don't want to have to claim that I have a bit of the villain in me for the way that I'm living my life. I believe in all sorts of rights, and at the same time, I tell body jokes. Sometimes I get really drunk. Sometimes, you know, in the past, I've made poor choices for sexual partners. Like, all of that is true. And I believe in things like LGBT rights and HIV awareness and the rest, and everything that I believe in. And none of that is compromised by the way that I'm living my life. Unless I'm like one of these weird asshole priests who are like, gay people must die, and then they're sucking all sorts of dick in the bathroom. That's very specific.
Okay, but why do you reject the idea of a villain in you then? What's wrong with that characterization?
Because what I am is human. I don't need to claim the villain to explain that sometimes my behavior doesn't live up to saintly standards.
That's interesting. Something about the notion of saying claiming the villain. I like the idea of claiming the villain, so I'm intrigued by the fact that you reject that.
Because I don't have to be a bad guy. No part of me has to be bad or evil or wicked for just to enjoy my life. As long as I'm making choices that are safe and I can live my life, I can go out in the streets and protest whatever I want if I'm not harming anybody.
What's wrong with being a villain?
Because villain, bad, wickedness, evil. The thing is that people who oppose social change are going to want to paint the people who are advocating for social change as something's wrong with them, they're bad, they're evil too. And I think by rejecting that, saying, well, actually, I don't have to be evil to have this point of view. I'm just a human, and I believe these things. I think that's more empowering than accepting what they're giving. They're trying to hand you the wickedness and say, well, you're wicked, Martin Luther King. You cheated on your wife. So now you want to say for racial equality? And he doesn't have to say, oh, I'm a very terrible person. He can say, I'm a human being, and I'm making choices in my family that have everything to do with me and my family. And I advocate for this.
So you're advocating and. You're and an expansion of your idea of humanity. Okay.
What I do in my personal time does not necessarily have to influence what I'm doing professionally, which is the exact perfect segue into my topic. I didn't even plan it. So my topic came out of an article I read on Gawker.com about this guy named Nick Solaris, who is a restaurant editor at Eater.com, which I guess is some sort of like weird foodie site.
Oh,
and
I've heard of that.
He was suspended. This is old news now, but I've been thinking about this for a while. He was suspended because he had a skinhead punk racist past where he would say and do all sorts of things. I don't think it erased the point of violence, but I think there was some videos or pictures that surfaced of him with various swastikas and white supremacist symbols. Anyway, Eater.com put him on leave for the stuff that came up. And it began this conversation online about whether your employer should have leave to punish you or make promotion, demotion decisions based on what you do in your personal time if it doesn't affect your professional obligations. So this guy, Solaris, you know, I don't even know what the fuck foodies are doing online. You can't taste or smell the food. I don't know what there is to discuss. But anyway, you know, he's online talking about food restaurants. It's not like he's only choosing to review white restaurants or talk about like white people food, which I guess is like what? I don't even know.
Mayonnaise?
Vanilla cake. Yeah, mayonnaise and vanilla cake with white bread. But it's not like that's what he's doing. He's just doing his job.
Rude of us.
I know, totally. What's more is that this is a past that he specifically disavowed. And now that at age, he's being punished for it. So my question to you guys is that should your employer have some sort of say, strike that, not say, but should you be punished for the things you do in your personal time?
Oh my God, this is so fascinating that you're bringing this up. Because this was sort of going to be my topic.
Well, it kind of sort of was, right? There was a connection to what you're saying.
You know, I think on the one hand, you know, a company, an employer has to look out for its self-interest. And if they have an employee who's doing things in their personal life that is being tied to the organization and what will hurt it, then I think the employer has a right, you know, to make a decision around that. I mean, I'm struck by, I feel like, Chris, a long time ago, you were on Facebook publicizing like what people were doing about, you know, you'd have someone say something very racist on Facebook and then it would be sent to the employer and the employer would fire them. I mean, I think that there's a extent to which that seems appropriate to me and also frankly useful for social change. That said, the scenario you're describing, I feel like if something's in someone's past and they disavow it, I don't know. I kind of feel like then the employer should not be able to take action.
See, the disavowing is the key point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I was just thinking the exact same thing, Jason. I was thinking about the principal who went on a racist rant and then was fired. Because the idea is though that if you hold these notions in your head and you're serving a population that's vulnerable and are sort of included in these notions, then how are we to be sure that that is not influencing your behavior? For example, isn't this somewhat, I mean, I guess maybe in the case of the cops who were found texting and tweeting racist things in San Francisco, is it because they were tweeting and texting those things to each other on the job that we should be thinking about? Or is it because what happens if we found these texts and it was off work time? I don't know if I can come down on one issue or the other, right?
Let me make this a little easier though, right? Because with the Nick Solaris thing, what I actually introduced is you have a past or someone has a past of which they did X, Y, and Z. It's now the present day. They have a job that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with their X, Y, and Z. It's just something they did a long time ago, and the disavowal thing is key. You're older, you're wiser, you don't do that anymore. For instance, an ex-con, let's say manslaughter, and now it's 20 years later and they want to get a job and they're forced to tell you about it. Can you hold it against them forever. What if you are a school teacher in your 40s, but when you were 18, you needed the money and you made a bunch of solo masturbation videos? You know, can we hold that against you forever? Let's talk about that first, and then we can talk about sort of the concurrent personal life, professional life stuff. So what do you guys think about that?
Well, I mean, past lives is obvious. I don't think you can hold it against a person unless it is directly related to some element of their job. I do think that we have to ask that we have to make a distinction about things that as they relate to the content of your work. I think in Nick's case, it's fairly clear that it's unrelated. But for example, if it was like a teacher who did masturbation videos, I think there are these assumptions that we make about certain environments where your character is a part and parcel of your job. I mean, I hate that that happens, but that is part of it. So I'm not entirely comfortable. I don't know if I'm uncomfortable with that. So I might have to just, you know, leave that open. If it's unrelated to your current job and it's a past thing that was maybe egregious and you have disavowed it and you have served your time and you have done what you were supposed to do, and I feel like we have to create spaces for people to change and move out of things that they did in the past.
I think there are two issues. One is what you're talking about, Tricia, in terms of character. That's one question. To what extent can we infer things about your character based on A, what you did in your past, B, what you do now in your personal time? And then the other is optics. And unfortunately, yeah. I do think employers have to think about both. It is the case. Like, let's say you're a news agency and you have a newscaster who turns out has an awful past, disavows it, but like it doesn't go away, because that happens, right? Like other people keep bringing it up and bringing it up and bringing it up. I do think there's a point where you might have to fire the person, and that sucks because there's a conflict between kind of individual right and the survival of the institution. But as an employer, like you have the survival of the institution is your primary responsibility. So I don't think there's like this, I mean, to, you know, what Chris was saying before, what you two were talking about before about complexity. This is complex. So I think optics, we can't ignore it. It can't just be, well, that's just optical, because optics make a difference. Whether people are going to send their kids to your school, whether people are going to consume your news, whether you're going to be able to do what you've set out to do as an institution. Like, I think that's real. And I don't think just because you have that past, that should automatically mean that you can be fired. But there's a point at which I feel like an employer can say, like, we can't conduct our business, we can't achieve our mission with this person on our staff, unfortunately. I think that's real. Then the character thing is another thing. And, you know, here's where I feel like the complexity comes in terms of A, like, are there clear indications that whatever you did in the past you have disavowed, and B, whatever you did, does that actually have an impact on how you do your work now? And I think both of those dynamics of both character and optics are, they have to be in play. Like, they have to be. Now, again, I think there should be protections that an employer can't just capriciously terminate someone, but there are thresholds in both of those areas that I think an employer should be able to terminate. What you're describing, Chris, the foodie, like, that sounds to me like I don't see why that person in that example should have to lose their job. But I definitely can imagine similar scenarios where they might have to lose their job, even if they don't continue to behave in the way that they did, even if they disavowed it.
Is this at all, am I raising a weird aside? Does this relate at all to the gay bakery situation?
Where
What's
is
the
it?
Gay Where is the gay bakery?
No, sorry.
Please text me the address.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No, but,
let's go.
No, but does this at all relate to some of the things that we talked about, I think, in our last podcast, where we're talking about your ability to serve a customer base whose lifestyle you don't agree with? Is this at all loosely?
No, this is different, because the employer-employee relationship is different from the customer-proprietor relationship. I mean, there's definitely some similarities, but I think what I'm specifically getting to here with the employer part about it is that the employer holds your livelihood in their hands. Mm-hmm. And in our society, I feel that we already give employers way too much power. They're controlling what kind of health care you get and how much you're going to pay for it and into what degree. They're holding life and death, which I think is already too much. I'm being dramatic, but for some people it is that way. Yeah, I hear what you're saying about optics, Jason, and I completely understand that, right? You can't, you know, if you run an organization where you work with children, you can't have someone who is convicted of child porn, even if this was like something stupid where he was 16 and his girlfriend was 16, they traded sexy nudes or something. Even that, something's innocent of that, like the optics of that, I'm sorry, you can't work here. While I understand that, I also am growing more sensitive to the fact that as our culture becomes more encrusted with technology and digitized video and information, is that we are all creating paths that none of us will be able to escape. And if that's the case, who is getting these jobs of the future? How are they going about it? Now listen, I have said and done some things in my 20s and teens that if it were to get out now, people would be shocked. I'm not talking about murder or anything like that, just opinions that I have held. Thank God Snapchat and Instagram and the rest of it did not exist back then.
Right, yeah.
No, but that's lucky for me, but what about people coming up today?
It's a great question.
I'm not certain how much power employers should have. Hey, look, I'm 50 years old, let's say. Back in the 80s, I did this whole thing, you know, whatever. I was pro-apartheid for whatever reasons. For whatever my limited understanding was of the South African system, I thought it was helpful. I've now learned my lesson. If it comes out that I'm pro-apartheid, should my 15-year career as an accountant come to an end with PricewaterhouseCoopers because they can't be seen to have like someone who promoted, supported apartheid on their staff? Like, what kind of sense does that make?
Okay, wait a minute.
No one's talking.
What are we waiting for?
Well, you know what? Okay, fine. I think I understand you made a distinction between past behavior.
Yes.
But when you start asking the question about the power of the employer, mm-hmm. I think it rears its head now in a kind of present question. You're asking about the boundaries between your personal and your private life.
Okay, yeah.
And your job. As soon as you gave the apartheid example, but you had disavowed it, which I think in some sense makes it a little easier to make the claim that, you know what happens in the past was the past.
Yeah.
But what happens if it's in the present?
Okay, well, that's a different question. We're going to shift away from the past question and move to the present question.
Because
I really think they're different animals.
Well, they're different animals, but there is a kind of strain to it that might have an impact on why people would not be able to do it with the past. Because are we making an assumption that there is some linkage between who you are in the past and who you continue to be in the present?
Well, that's what the employer, like in the case of Eater.com, that's they're making that connection. Are you guys making that connection?
Well, I think with all this stuff, I mean, there's a need for nuanced policy. I mean, there's also the question of
complexity over it.
No, right, exactly. But I mean, then you have a question about past, like, well, how long ago must it have been?
Exactly.
I could have 10 years. Tweeted a racist tweet yesterday, and I was like, you know what? I woke up this morning, and I totally disagree. I wish I hadn't done that. No, I'm serious, though. Like, that shit happens.
No, celebrities do it all the time.
All the time. Exactly.
Celebrities do it all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, this is one of those areas where I like to say everything is about where you draw the line. And there's no perfect place to draw the line. There's not a right or wrong answer. There's a balance between employers' rights and employees' rights. There's a balance between character and optics and is this really going to have a negative impact on your organization's ability to get its job done? If, let's say, I'm like, right now, I tweet, like, I wish we still, like, South Africa still had apartheid, and then I work in a restaurant. Like, does that, there should be policy around if an employer is going to fire someone for something they did in their personal life, whether it's the past, the present, last week, 20 years ago, then maybe they should, and I'm just riffing off this right now, like, I haven't given this a lot of thought, but maybe they should have to demonstrate that it has an impact on the organization's ability to get its work done. And if an employee gets terminated and they then, you know, sue or whatever, and the employer can't demonstrate that, then they should be entitled to, you know, certain compensation, whatever. I don't think we can come up with a hard and fast rule that's fair here.
It is interesting, though, because I do think that we might have to draw the line at efficacy on the job, because that's essentially the essential quality that we are exploring as an employee.
You run into problems immediately, though, when you lay that out, though.
But you have to, because think about it. You're at this point in time, I don't care if you're a bad person. Because
just
that's
get your job done.
Just that's, I mean, on some level, right? On some level, you have to begin to pull back a little bit. It's so funny because I was talking with a colleague yesterday, and we were talking about how at times we've worked in jobs where the job wanted our personal brand, I hate to use that term, but it is a thing, to bleed into the work. And I've always resisted that because I do think it's really important to create that distinction between work Trisha and personal Trisha. Because I can imagine that there may be times when personal Trisha doesn't work for work Trisha, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think when we clarify that relationship between employer-employee, I think that really is the place to start. Your employability is tied into your ability to help that employer do what it wants to do in the marketplace.
I agree.
However, butts up against that, mm-hmm. that's a valid space.
But that almost always does. I just want to clarify.
No, not necessarily. Why? Why would it almost?
I want to clarify something that Jason said earlier about my involvement on getting people fired or whatever on Facebook. So there is a Facebook group which. And I don't think I follow it so much anymore. There's a Facebook group that targets people who trade racist memes on social media and tracks it back, finds their employer, and then emails it to them, which I applaud. But, you know, this is funny because I'm about to disavow this, right? I don't know if I disavow that behavior. I don't know if I disagree with that now. But, I mean, in light of this conversation, and now we're talking about present-day beliefs, the thing about today is that if I know that you are trading, like, you know, Obama monkey memes, and I know that you work for UPS, as someone, let's say I own my own business, I have a choice about who I can use, UPS or FedEx. So I'm going to choose FedEx just because I have a bad taste in my mouth, because the last time I heard the words UPS, it was with the term Obama monkey meme.
Right.
So when you talk about efficacy in your job, this person's current beliefs is directly impacting UPS's ability to make money.
Therefore, and you can then fire them. Yeah, but you can fire them because you are now messing what happens with the customer.
I think we're agreeing.
We're agreeing.
Okay, so let me just paint a dark dystopian picture for you.
Yeah. Keep going.
We love dystopia. We should change the name of this podcast.
From outrageous to dystopia. Let's flash forward. Let's flash forward to July of 2018. Mm-hmm. Trump is firmly in the White House, right? Mm-hmm. There's a wall on the southern border. Women need to ask their fathers or husbands before they can get before they can see a gynecologist, and all the gynecologists are men. I don't know. Like, it's a wild, crazy world. And because Trump has won the presidency, at least 50% of the population believes certain things. Now, I am a gay man, and let's say I work at McDonald's, right? Mm-hmm. Now, 50% of the population has voted for Trump, and they have certain ideas about people like me. So when people come in and I am there fabulously attending to their needs, they don't like it. They don't want to get their burger for some gay dude. So my employer says, hey, well, you're fucking with my business now, and you have to go. Or maybe it's not even me being gay. Maybe it's the fact of opinions that I hold, the fact that I didn't want Trump to be elected in the first place. I have to go. Now, I think right now in culture and society, a lot of the people who are getting fired and having their lives ruined is because they hold opinions counter to what the three of us consider to be appropriate. Yeah. But if that should change, then what are we saying? Do you still think it'd be appropriate for employers to fire people based on their personal beliefs?
I don't think – listen. This is what I'm saying. An employer has a relationship with an employee that is wholly – defensible on legal grounds, right? That's what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. So if in the case of the white supremacist, that person gets fired for the Obama monkey jokes and they can bring a legal case against that employer, then, oh, sucks to be that employer. But you know what? There are protections for that person. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, I can't legalize morality. So on in either case, if you've left yourself open to being sued, then there isn't enough protections regardless of the moral landscape. So yeah, I'm okay with the white supremacist getting fired because yes, you're right, it doesn't agree with my point of view. But if that employer didn't check the rule books and the legality of that firing, they're kind of screwed. So I mean, yes, I mean, I think we have to admit to a certain cultural landscape, but then at the same time recognize that we have to know if that cultural landscape has been sort of like affirmed in the legal in law.
I do want to. There's one thing that you two keep saying that I want to raise.
What?
I do not think beliefs should come into this at all.
Because what do you mean beliefs?
Well, you guys have said like, well, can you be fired for this belief if you believe that? I think beliefs should be out of bounds because you can never definitively ascertain someone's beliefs.
I think
it's got to be
your
based.
But your beliefs are being assessed through action. That's the
thing. Action should be judged, not the belief.
But see, but the only reason why your actions are being judged is because your belief is being judged.
No, yeah. I disagree. Your actions being judged because that's what has an impact on the company or the organization. Or
Jason,
no, that's
Jason,
not what,
come on.
That's not what's being disavowed.
Well, but I disagree. But that, if that's the case, I disagree with it. So, Jason,
I believe women are stupid. Now, I have a job available, and both of you can apply. What do you think is going to happen next?
But how do I know that you believe women are stupid?
Because I just told
According to Jason, it's not your belief that women are stupid that's going to get you fired. It's because you shared a meme that said women are stupid that's going to get you fired.
Or I look at a pattern of whom you've hired and whom you've terminated, and I see that you are hiring and retaining men disproportionate to women. When we were in college, the president of Rutgers University in a meeting said something to the effect of how can we improve black students' performance at our university when we know that genetically, like, they're not going to perform at the same level. It's something like that. I'm sure I'm not getting that right. Wow. And it was recorded, it was leaked, and it led to enormous student protests, primarily black students, saying that he had to go. And his argument was, I misspoke, I don't believe that, and if you look at my record, you can see I don't believe that. And you had a split among the faculty and other supporters and people affiliated with the university where some people were saying, I know him, he doesn't believe that, he shouldn't have to go. And other people saying, he said it, he needs to go. And I'll just tell you where I came down on this. I don't give a shit what he believes because I don't know what he believes, and there's no way to prove or disprove what he believes. But a university president saying things like that should not be a university president because they are running an institution with a large black population. Their mission is to educate a lot of black students as well as other students, and if you're saying things like that in meetings, you're not going to be effective. I think it's got to stay there because you could say I believe something and I could disagree with you, and how can we ever prove it? But if you look at my behavior, either in my personal life or my professional life, then you can make a determination of whether I am effective at doing my job in the organization.
Trisha?
I think we might be getting this whole thing muddied. So let's unmuddy it a little bit. All we can do is evaluate people's past, present actions and its impact on a company.
Agreed.
That's all you can do.
That's what I'm saying. That was my point.
So regardless of the landscape that we exist in, whether it's a conservative landscape or a liberal landscape, this is why we have to be in the service of like trying to change the landscape. Because in some sense, the landscape will control the marketability of the company, doesn't it? Right now, we're in a sort of quote-unquote liberal landscape. So having someone in your company that has a past or a current present that is not liberal may have some real serious impact on your ability to sell things in the marketplace, whatever it is that you're selling. That's all you can do as a company. The idea that you have to hold on to an employee that is going to impact your bottom line, that's a really tricky thing, because I can imagine someone coming back and saying, well, what if I have black people and they're really getting in the way of me and my bottom line? I might want to just eliminate black people. That I can immediately see the response to that. But right now we're talking about employer-employee relationship and whatever legal protections exist in that space.
This is why there are certain things like Title IX that if Trump becomes president or whatever, like, we've got to fight like hell to keep in place, because there do need to be protected classes
of people
within all of this. And again, this is why this policy needs to be, I think, very nuanced. I just want to – just one other thing to go back to the beliefs thing. I remember when Andrew Dice Clay was very popular, again, when we were in high school. He would say these terribly misogynistic and racist things, and then – you know, he would say, and his publicist would say, like, oh, it's just an act. And I can remember Jay Leno, this shows how old I am, but, like, how Jay Leno then saying, like, I don't buy that it's just an act. And again, my thing was, like, that's not the right question. Is he saying things that are promoting misogyny and racism? Whether he believes them or not, are they having that impact on other people? And if they are, and I'm not saying it should have been illegal, this is a different question, but just, like, then yes, it should be condemned. If everybody sees it as a joke and ultimately it's undermining misogyny and racism, great. But, like, this conversation about beliefs, I just think there's a line. And, like, what's inside me, my motivations, my beliefs, my feelings, is always debatable. And so I just think it should not be in policy.
Actually, you know what, Jason? You just swayed me with that.
Yay!
Yeah.
Point, no, Jason.
I know. I'm
for once convinced Chris. Jason,
they've been swaying you? How?
You know what? You know what? He makes a lot of sense. He makes a lot of sense. You know what? Because I just did a gut. I did a gut check, and there are definitely things that I think belief might be a strong word, but there are definitely things that I entertain in my head that either I would never say out loud or actually never bleed into my actions. Now, you have to take my word for it. I know they don't, but there are certain things that I believe, and you know what? It's fine. You know, and I'm trying to think of the safest one I could say out loud.
Yeah, tell us them all, Chris.
Okay, so
let's do this.
I mean, in my day job and my other jobs, I work with children a lot, and I don't like all those children. You know, some of them I really don't like for a variety of reasons, but it doesn't actually impact my work. I still fight for them. I still, well, I can though. Like, I know that what I'm saying is that you have to take my word for it. But in my own gut check, the same thing that's telling me I don't like these children, I can be honest with myself. I know I'm being honest about the work that I'm doing for them.
Well, and so what I'm saying is I don't have to take your word for it. I just evaluate your work. And if I'm like, there are these kids that you're totally fucking, Chris, then, like,
you're
fired.
You don't know.
Like, I don't know why it is. I'm not going to speculate. It's just fired.
But, you know, but the other thing is, yeah, I guess that's it, like, if I suck. But, no, I understand what you're saying about beliefs, Jason. I think – and we've been saying this all podcast, I think it's a lot more nuanced. It's not as concrete as that, but I get what you're saying about it. I appreciate it. All right. Let's get into recommendations, which is some media event, something that you saw, heard, or experienced that you think other people should see, hear, or experience, or the exact opposite of that.
Or something else entirely.
Yeah, or if you're Jason, just, you know, just do a little scat bebop, and that's fun. I'm going to go first today. I teased this earlier. There is a great video series. It's on YouTube. Like, I don't know if TV is a thing that people watch anymore, but it's associated with MTV in some way. It's called Decoded. And it's a series where this one – she's not a comedian. I don't know if she's a journalist. She's just – there's a black woman named Francesca Ramsey, and she – you've seen this. She tackles issues of race and pop culture, and she kind of, like, pulls things apart. She did one about, like, the uncomfortably racist history of the word Caucasian. She did one about
it's such a weird word.
Yeah, no. Well, you should watch her video. The problems of white beauty standards and just things about affirmative action, and she just really pulls apart using history and humor and pop culture references to really instruct. And I would highly recommend it. It's really cool. So that's my recommendation. Experience it, everyone. Go out and experience it. Decoded.
So my recommendation is Columbia Gateway Dentistry.
No, this is not.
No, it is. I swear to God, it is.
Oh my God, Jason! I swear to God. You know what you said at the top of the podcast? You have things to do. You think of a topic. You think of a recommendation.
What? I thought about it. I thought about this recommendation.
This is not a media event. Someone cleans your teeth and you want to talk about it? Who gives a fuck? Are you kidding me with this?
Here's the thing. A, I have been to so many terrible dentists.
Okay, so this is a real thing. Okay.
dentists who... I make an appointment and then I show up in their clothes. Dentists
who,
like...
my headphones.
And as a child, I hated going to the dentist. I found the dentist mean, and like I just did not like it.
Oh my God!
I took my kids yesterday to the dentist. I
can't believe.
And we've been going to this dentist for a few years.
Trisha, this
no,
is
I'm
happening.
Serious though. This dentist is so phenomenal that and takes insurance. I don't pay a penny out of my pocket.
Okay.
And my kids, I can send you pictures. They were
Please
so
don't.
Ecstatic. They had such a great time. And what I want to say is I know there's no excuse anymore for bad dentistry. And, like, it is time for the bar to be raised. And I am just letting people know that, like, there is a standard out there. And whatever we can do to get more dentists to that standard, I'd love to think about. And okay, I'm happy to take money from any source to help act, you know, advocate for better dentistry aligned with this provider that I've recently taken my kids to.
Let's have some silence around this topic so I can cut this whole thing out later. Okay, I'm just going to edit around this. I'm just going to have like a sound bite of like Jason burping or something. We'll send some recommendation. Jason, I honestly like, you know what I mean? Like, seriously, I've known you for like 22, 23 years. And I just want to say, like, honestly, this moment, I'm completely done with you. I don't know what to say to you anymore. So, Trisha, please. Trisha, you get to do two recommendations now.
I don't know. I can handle two. I'm simply going to stick with one.
It's an honest recommendation. If you live anywhere within 100 miles of Columbia Gateway Dentistry in Columbia, God. Maryland, that's where you should go.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks. I'm going to fly from California there, I think.
You should. You totally. It's worth it. I swear to God it's worth it. I'll pick you up from the airport and take you. It's 10 minutes from
Trisha,
BWI.
Please, Trisha, please start talking. Begging.
All right. So I'm really conscious now of my recommendations.
It cannot be worse than that. It can't be.
You know, I'm always recommending fun podcasts because I really believe in podcasts. But you I know some people. I do, obviously. But I can't stand the idea of sitting and listening to anything for longer than, I don't know, 10, 20 minutes. So I'm going to recommend.
She says on our 2-hour podcast, I expect you motherfuckers to listen to me for 2 hours, but I'm not listening to you for more than 10 minutes.
I mean, I'm just being honest. I know a lot of people, and a lot of people that are not always up for everything. So anyway, I have this sort of, I've been following this podcast called Becoming Wise, and it's actually now a book, but so yeah, the Becoming Wise podcast, on average, I think they're about 15 minutes, and they're just these little nuggets of sort of interesting ideas that the host just explores with. It's almost like a sort of a vignette of a longer conversation that the host is having, but she'll take like a nugget and post it. And it's, you know, I think sometimes that's kind of good. Like, you know,
of like a conversation, like in the in the middle of a conversation.
Like in the middle of like in the middle of the conversation, maybe the author will expound on an idea that he's thinking of. And so she'll edit that piece and put it into a podcast. And I think it's actually quite nice because you'll just go, you know, oh, you listen to it for 10 minutes and maybe you can ponder it for the rest of the day. Like,
what's the name of this? I'm curious now.
It's called Becoming Wise. Becoming Wise. And no joke, it's not very long. And it's usually, I think the inspiration is that if you find the notion that it explores that moment compelling, there's always something you can go ahead and do. Like, one of my favorite is there's a Twitter folk that I follow, and it's Maria Popovoff. It's a website where just like they pull together sort of interesting ideas and send it out to the universe, and you can read it. And so it'll be something like, what do philosophers think about the meaning of life or the eye or something like that? And they'll pull in all sorts of different people's perspective on that, and you can just read it. But what they do is they make the ideas connected in a sort of seamless flow. So she interviewed the person who curates that website. And it was just a really brief interview. And so what was really great about it is that host talked about how do you push back on this sort of age of cynicism that we're living in. And it was just a really interesting conversation, and it was 10 minutes long. And I really left listening to the podcast thinking about cynicism and how that's the root of some very, very bad things culturally. So I just think that you can have a really cool nugget. Maybe your commute's really short and you listen to this podcast, or maybe you can listen to a series of them, but they're very short and you can have like leave your commute with four or five different ideas.
Oh.
Something to consider.
That was a great recommendation. I am concerned that people are going to hear it and say, I think I'm going to start listening to that instead of pop, instead of this fucking outrageous 2-hour podcast.
Yeah. You know what? I think people can.
You're fired, Trisha. Trisha just did something that undermined our mission. You're fired.
No, I think people can listen to more than one podcast at a time. Or they might listen to that podcast and they'll be like, ugh, this was too short. I just need three people going blathering on for 90 minutes at least. You know what I mean? So maybe we'll drive people to this podcast. All right, you two. So thanks for playing. This has been a lot of fun. And listeners, thanks for listening. Go out and get your teeth whitened.
Yes.
Dentist voice. You idiot.
Dr. Gozadi.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.